Chapter 31 Sin Against Humanity. Ulysses S. Grant, who had often shown signs of a speculative bent, could never quite resist the allure of buccaneering tycoons of the Gilded Age. This most trusting of men was perhaps destined to draw the wiles of two of Wall Street's most conniving moguls, Jay Gould and James Fisk, Jr. In spring 1869, Gould concocted a plan to corner the market in gold, driving up its price. As it duly rose, Secretary of the Treasury Boutwell spoiled the scheme by selling additional gold from government coffers. He had embarked on weekly gold sales in exchange for greenbacks, using the proceeds to shrink the large federal debt. This overhang of government gold always threatened to undo any advance in gold prices. Faced with this impediment, Gould and Fisk undertook a campaign of seduction aimed at persuading Grant to restrict gold sales by the Treasury Department. Both directors of the Erie Railroad, Gould and Fisk, made up an unlikely duo, a short, neat man with a full beard and piercing eyes. Gould had grown up as a poor farmer's son in upstate New York. As a young man, he had devised a better mousetrap, foreshadowing the damage he would later do to Wall Street rivals. Coldly exacting, shunning the limelight, he had amassed a colossal fortune through a railroad network spanning the nation and came to personify the predatory instincts of contemporary tycoons. "The people had desired money before Gould," Mark Twain observed, "but he taught them to fall down and worship it." Indeed, Gould's audacious moves riveted and appalled the nation in equal measure. With his handsome blonde mustache, bloated frame, and diamond rings, the flashy Jim Fisk was the antithesis of the saturnine Gould. The son of a Vermont peddler, he collected prostitutes and chorus girls no less promiscuously than he bought railroads and steamships, and exulted in the attention his flamboyance aroused. Such was his roguish charm that people were captivated even as they were horrified by his total lack of scruples. As George Templeton Strong sketched him, "Illiterate, vulgar, unprincipled, profligate, always making himself conspicuously ridiculous by some piece of flagrant ostentation, he was nevertheless free-handed with his stolen money, and possessed, moreover, a certain magnetism of geniality that attracted to him people who were not particular about the decency of their associates. Every decent conspiracy demands a saintly cover story, and Gould had cleverly devised one that identified his personal avarice with the national interest. He argued that higher gold prices would produce a corresponding decline in the value of greenbacks, and thus artificially cheapen exports, allowing American farmers to reap bountiful sales abroad. Inasmuch as Gould also functioned as a major proprietor of East-West railroads, he stood to make a double killing, profiting from levitating gold prices and rising freight loads to eastern ports. To peddle this self-serving economic theory, Gould needed a conduit to Grant, and found a willing one in Abel Rathbone Corbin, a slippery man who had dabbled in law, journalism, and politics, even investing money for Julia Grant in New York real estate. Gould saw him as a very shrewd old gentleman, while a less charitable journalist sneered at him as the most consummate old hypocrite I ever saw. Most important, he had recently married Grant's sister, Virginia, known as Jenny. In her late 30s, Jenny was suffering the fate of an old maid and living with her parents in Covington when the 61-year-old Corbin wooed her. Grant, who was fond of his sister, had known Corbin since his St. Louis days in the 1850s and gave away the bride at the wedding. "You will be surprised when I tell you I have just finished a letter of congratulation to Miss Jenny Grant," Julia informed a friend in late April. Thrilled by the match, she noted that Corbin was an old friend of ours and we are all well pleased. Julia would shortly have reason to eat these words. Gould had indoctrinated Corbyn with his pet theory about the benefits of higher gold prices, and Corbyn, acting his part to perfection, began to flog it to Grant. The cynical Fisk saw Corbyn as the cat's paw of the whole conspiracy. Why, damn it, old Corbyn married into Grant's family for the purpose of working the thing in that direction. That's all he married for this last time. Whatever the scheme's genesis, Gould traded brazenly on his supposed intimacy with Corbyn, who traded on his supposed intimacy with Grant, even as Grant seemed oblivious to the web of intrigue being sedulously spun around him. When the post of assistant treasurer in New York fell vacant, Corbyn and Gould lobbied successfully for the appointment of Major General Daniel Butterfield, who lacked any background in finance. He had been chief of staff for Joseph Hooker during the war and was credited with creating the bugle call TAPS. The assistant treasurer post was critical to the machinery of Gould's plot because the all-important gold sales were conducted through his Wall Street office. When Butterfield started work on July 1st, Gould offered him a $10,000 bribe, binding him to the conspiracy. Butterfield preferred to characterize the money as an unsecured real estate loan. The plot tempo quickened in mid-June 1869 when Grant, after visiting Fred at West Point, stopped by the Corbyns' West 27th Street townhouse. While he was there, Jay Gould dropped by to say hello and extended an offer to the president to cruise to Massachusetts the following evening aboard Fisk's steamboat, Providence, an offer that Grant, headed for Boston, naively accepted. Grant could sound cynical about the self-made men of his time, saying they worship money rather than country, but he found it hard to fend off their unctuous overtures. Once afloat, Gould and Fisk sprang their trap on Grant, steering the conversation to crop exports and Boutwell's weekly gold sales. They wanted to convince Grant that Boutwell should halt such sales and galvanize the economy. For a long time, Grant listened silently, then hazarded the opinion that the current prosperity had a fictitious air and the speculative bubble might as well be pricked one way or another. His attitude, that the economy was excessively inflated and needed no stimulus, stopped the conspirators dead in their tracks. "We supposed from that conversation that the president was a contractionist," said Gould. His remark struck across us like a wet blanket. Disheartened, Gould let his gold purchases lapse for a while until a more auspicious opportunity arose. Gould went on plying Grant with favors, and Grant, heedless of appearances, accepted them. In mid-August, the Grants and the Corbyns left New York aboard a private railroad car furnished by the Erie Railroad to travel to Kane, a scenic spot in western Pennsylvania where the president went trout fishing. Gould and Fisk boarded the luxurious car to make sure the accommodations suited the president. In the town of Susquehanna, Gould and Fisk gave Grant a private tour of their locomotive works and repair shops. Around this time, the two speculators resumed their gold purchases. After touring Pennsylvania, Grant headed for Newport, Rhode Island, and was lobbied en route by Jim Fisk, who told him that unless the Treasury Department withheld gold, the Republican Party would be blamed for heavy losses sustained by farmers and railroad workers across America. Grant responded in an exemplary manner, saying it would not be fair to tell any private citizen what the Treasury Department planned to do. In early September, Gould heated up the plot, purchasing $1.5 million in gold for the Corbyns and a like sum for General Butterfield. When Gould again met him at the Corbyn home, Grant said reports of an abundant harvest had persuaded him gold prices should be kept high to aid crop exports. Gould was delighted. Grant had finally jumped at the bait. Grant wrote to Boutwell and argued the need to keep gold high to accelerate crop sales abroad. With good reason, Gould imagined he had recruited Grant to his scheme. To mask his trading moves, he executed gold purchases through a Byzantine network of brokers. During the second week of September, Grant returned to the Corbins' townhouse, and Jay Gould called anew. Grant at last sensed something terribly amiss and told their servant never to admit Gould again. "Gould was always trying to get something out of him," Grant complained. On September 12th, he dashed off a letter to Boutwell about the bulls and bears of Wall Street that showed his awareness that people on both sides of the gold trade were trying to manipulate him. "The fact is, a desperate struggle is now taking place, and each party wants the government to help them out. I write this letter to advise you of what I think you may expect, to put you on your guard." Whatever his earlier naivete, Grant now grasped the designs upon him, and Boutwell adhered to his liberal policy of selling gold. Meanwhile, rumors of financial skullduggery floated freely in New York, Horace Greeley warning that certain financiers were colluding to push gold up to an exorbitant rate. On September 13th, the Grants left New York to spend several days in southwest Pennsylvania. 3 days later, Gould made a bald-faced effort to bribe Horace Porter. "We have purchased $500,000 gold on your account." Porter responded impeccably, "I have not authorized any purchase of gold and request that none be made on my account." On September 17th, Abel Corbin wrote Grant a letter urging a curb on government gold sales and warning of calamitous consequences without it. This letter was whisked off to the president by William Chapin, an Erie Railroad employee, in the pay of Jim Fisk. That Grant had banned further visits from Gould should have alerted Corbin that the scales had belatedly fallen from his eyes, and that such a letter would be seen as one entreaty too many. When Chapin reached southwest Pennsylvania a day later, he spied Grant playing croquet on the lawn with Porter. He waited in the house, then hand-delivered the letter to Grant, who absorbed its contents silently before disappearing for a while. When he returned, Chapin asked for his response to the message. "Is it all right?" he asked. "All right," Grant echoed, indicating he would have no response. It was a studiously neutral reply, but Chapin sent Fisk an ambiguously worded telegram that stated, "Delivered. All right," which implied to Gould's cold raptor eyes that Grant had heeded Corbin's admonition to check gold sales, turning him into an unwitting accomplice of the conspiracy. The stratagem boomeranged on Gould and Corbin, since Grant found it highly suspicious that they had dispatched a messenger to western Pennsylvania to deliver a simple letter. At once, Grant asked Julia to send a message to his sister Jenny, warning about the gold purchases. As Julia remembered its gist, "The general says if you have any influence with your husband, tell him to have nothing whatever to do with Gould. If he does, he will be ruined, for come what may, he, your brother, will do his duty to the country." Grant blamed himself for not having stopped Corbin sooner in his mad spree of unwanted advice about boosting gold and saving the country. "I always felt great respect for Corbin," he told Julia, "and thought he took much pleasure in the supposition that he was rendering great assistance to the administration by his valuable advice. I blame myself now for not checking this, as I thought, innocent vanity. It is very sad. I fear he may be ruined. And my poor sister." Grant never broke off relations with Corbin and would prove surprisingly forgiving toward him, exchanging pleasant letters with him before too long. Julia's letter had the intended impact on Jenny Corbin, who pleaded with her husband to desist from further gold speculations. When Gould visited the Corbin house, Corbin tried to unload his gold position. "Ulysses thinks it wrong," he explained, "and that it ought to end." Gould quickly fathomed the significance of Grant's letter to the Corbins. "Mr. Corbin," he announced, "I am undone if that letter gets out." He decided to liquidate his position before Boutwell made his next gold sale, which would shatter the conspiracy. Gould still made small gold purchases, but only to gull traders as he dumped gold. Meanwhile, gold prices consistently rose thanks to steady buying and voluble encouragement from Jim Fisk, who knew nothing of Gould's planned sales. On September 22nd, Fisk appeared in the Gold Room, a specialized commodity market next to the stock exchange, and loudly brayed buy orders to rally gold bulls, claiming Grant was solidly on their side. Large throngs milled outside, eager to witness the climax of the gold corner. After markets closed on September 23rd, Boutwell came to Grant, who had just returned from Pennsylvania, to discuss the gyrating gold prices unsettling Wall Street. That day, Fisk and his allies had driven gold prices sky high, damaging many bears and inciting frenzied trading in the gold room. 100 short sellers covered their losses by bidding gold to unimaginable heights. It was expected to soar even more the next day. As Boutwell recalled, "I then said that a sale of gold should be made for the purpose of breaking the market and ending the excitement. Grant asked me what sum I proposed to sell. I said $3 million will be sufficient to break the combination." Whether wishing to punish Gould and Fisk or simply alarmed by the turbulent trading, Grant replied, "I think you had better make it $5 million. In the end, Boutwell placed an order with General Butterfield in New York to sell $4 million worth of gold. According to one version of the story, Butterfield tipped off Gould before traders learned the news. Another claims Gould and his cronies tapped telegraph wires that carried news of the Treasury's action and exploited a brief 25-minute window to jettison more than $60 million in gold before prices crashed. In the interval before the news hit, the price of gold zoomed sharply higher. Many in the gold room didn't simply suspect that the Grant administration had turned a blind eye to the price manipulation, but that it had cooperated with its perpetrators. Friends of the administration openly stated that the president or yourself must have given these men to feel you would not interfere with them, or they would never dare to rush gold up so rapidly, a Wall Street operative told Boutwell. In truth, many parties of real responsibility and friends of the government openly declared that somebody in Washington must be in this combination. Grant and Boutwell were set to refute with a dramatic flourish these malicious rumors noised abroad by Fisk and his myrmidons. Shortly after Boutwell's telegram was received on Friday morning, September 24th, the surging gold market collapsed, the price per ounce plummeting from $160 to $133, plunging the trading world into chaos. Gould emerged unscathed from a debacle that wiped out many Wall Street dealers and went down in history as Black Friday. Fisk described the chaos in the gold room as the wildest confusion and the most unearthly screaming of men. By day's end, it was each man drag out his own corpse. Gould and Fisk fled for their personal safety. The gold room was shut down for a week to restore order and deal with the wreckage. The economic repercussions were extensive. The gold room mayhem shaved 20% from stock market prices and cut trading volume in half for months, while 14 stock exchange firms failed. Grant's dealings with Gould, Fisk, and Corbin show that even as president, he was still the same trusting rube who had been hoodwinked by business sharpers before the war. His sin was one of naivete, not malice or lack of scruples, his sole concern being the welfare of the country. "This is only one of 1,000 instances in which the president has been duped," James H. Wilson wrote, regretting Rawlins's sudden absence. The gold corner set the pattern for future Grant scandals. The personal integrity of the president was never questioned, only his judgment in consorting with unsavory characters, oblivious to the impression it might create. He was a soft touch for schemers, and this began to tarnish his public image. Robert Bonner, the editor of the New York Ledger, pleaded with Grant to make a public statement disclaiming all foreknowledge of that combination in order to relieve yourself entirely from all responsibility for the acts of others. Lincoln had been a master at sending letters to newspaper editors that gave important glimpses into his thinking. Now Grant penned a letter to Bonner that said, "I had no more to do with the late gold excitement in New York City than yourself or any other innocent party, except that I ordered the sale of gold to break the ring engaged, as I thought, in a most disreputable transaction." Bonner wired back that his statement had struck the bullseye. "Your letter has already done a vast deal of good." Butterfield was never charged with a crime and always maintained his innocence, but his reputation had been sullied, and Grant asked for his resignation. The House Committee on Banking and Currency launched an investigation, with some members hoping to tar Grant himself, but the worst charge they could level was his lack of judgment in accepting the hospitality of Gould and Fisk. Though innocent himself, Grant had allowed himself to be carried briefly in the talons of two of Wall Street's most rapacious financiers. "With the conventional air of assumed confidence," wrote Henry Adams, "everyone in public assured everyone else that the president himself was the savior of the situation, and in private assured each other that if the president had not been caught this time, he was sure to be trapped the next, for the ways of Wall Street were dark and double." By this point, Adams had emerged as the most waspish critic of the Grant administration. He rated Grant the greatest general the world had seen since Napoleon, but his political behavior was another matter. It wasn't surprising that a fastidious Boston Brahmin such as Adams would find Grant uncouth and boorish, a common reaction among the Eastern intelligentsia. The grandson of John Quincy Adams and the son of former U.S. Minister in London Charles Francis Adams Sr., Henry Adams counted William Dean Howells, Henry James, and John Hay among his glittering galaxy of friends. A thoroughgoing snob and Washington resident, he found the capital a social backwater and groaned that no literary or scientific man, no artist, no gentleman had ever lived there. Adams must have sensed that Grant loathed his entire clan. In one letter, Grant wrote that, "I confess to a repugnance to the appointment of an Adams," and in another he protested that the family did not possess one noble trait of character that I ever heard of, from old John Adams down to the last of all of them, H.B. Henry Adams's failure to secure a niche in the Grant administration dealt a blow to his family vanity and amour-propre. The chief of the spurned literati, he became a scathing critic of the spoils system under Grant and savaged his appointees with a pen dipped in vitriol. He damned Grant's cabinet as mediocrities, especially Boutwell, although he saved kind words for Secretary of the Interior Cox and Attorney General Hoar. "My family is buried politically beyond recovery for years," he complained. "I am becoming more and more isolated as far as allies go." Adams didn't receive from Grant the social deference to which he felt entitled and recorded this mordant impression of a White House reception in December 1869. "At last, Mrs. Grant strolled in. She squints like an isosceles triangle, but is not more vulgar than some duchesses. Her sense of dignity did not allow her to talk to me, but occasionally she condescended to throw me a constrained remark." Adams got his revenge with a series of withering aperçus about Grant that have clung like barnacles to his historical reputation. He said the initials U.S. stood for uniquely stupid. His most barbed comment was that Grant had single-handedly refuted Darwinian evolution. "The progress of evolution from President Washington to President Grant was alone evidence enough to upset Darwin." The comments, both hilarious and totally unfair, have been irresistible fodder for historians. Adams saw Grant as lacking a guiding sense of purpose as he piloted the ship of state, reducing governance to discrete issues devoid of an overarching design. By an extraordinary coincidence, Adams occupied the same G Street boarding house as Adam Badeau, whom he recalled as a stout, red-faced, bespectacled little man. They shared a common fascination with the Grant enigma. Badeau boasted that only he and John Rawlins had truly understood the general. Adams and Badeau agreed that Grant came alive amid wartime danger, then lapsed back into inertia when the threat subsided. As Adams expressed it, when in action, he was superb and safe to follow. Only when torpid, he was dangerous. He summarized Badeau's similar view. To him, Grant appeared as an intermittent energy, immensely powerful when awake, but passive and plastic in repose. For all his hero worship of Grant, Badeau harbored secret reservations that he voiced to Henry Adams, who summarized them thus. Badeau said that neither he nor the rest of the staff knew why Grant succeeded. They believed in him because of his success. For stretches of time, his mind seemed torpid. Rawlins and the others would systematically talk their ideas into it for weeks, not directly, but by discussion among themselves in his presence. In the end, he would announce the idea as his own, without seeming conscious of the discussion, and would give the orders to carry it out with all the energy that belonged to his nature. They could never measure his character or be sure when he would act. They could never follow a mental process in his thought. They were not sure that he did think. Though the portrait was overdrawn, Grant clearly thought a great deal about many matters. He did pick up ideas by a strange process of osmosis and made them fully his own. Many people said they could not follow the steps of his mental development because they were often secretive, interior, and hidden from view, the result of a powerfully intuitive process. Grant didn't have a systematic mind, nor did he arrange his ideas inside a larger theoretical scaffolding, and he was therefore a mystery to himself and others. When Henry Adams probed people about Grant's extraordinary success, they all seemed dumbfounded. "We do not know why the president is successful. We only know that he succeeds." While he proved a constant irritant to Grant, Adams was merely a gadfly who posed no enduring threat beyond his wickedly funny pen. Far more fraught was the relationship with another prickly Bostonian, Senator Charles Sumner, whose differences with Grant would fester and assume the dimensions of a pathological feud that bloodied both participants. As shown in his zeal for Andrew Johnson's impeachment, the redoubtable Sumner could be motivated by idealism and implacable hatred at once. He was in many ways a kindred spirit to the curmudgeonly Adams. "The boy, Henry, worshipped him," Adams wrote, "and if he ever regarded any older man as a personal friend, it was Mr. Sumner." Handsome, Harvard-educated, a cosmopolitan traveler, Sumner had long been adored by abolitionists. Right before the Civil War, his anti-slavery crusade led the South Carolina representative Preston Brooks to thrash him severely with a cane on the Senate floor, transforming him into a secular saint. As he droned on in endless, windy speeches, the sanctimonious Sumner was easier to admire than to love. A cold, humorless bachelor, he sashayed around Washington with his walking stick, glorying in his self-importance. As Grant's son Jesse recalled, he was a tall man of commanding appearance, rendered doubly conspicuous by the garments he wore. "He always wore the most glaring clothes I have ever seen on a civilized man, heavy plaids in vividly contrasting colors looming above a foundation of white spats." Sumner's Mandarin hauteur stood opposed to Grant's modesty, and his Baroque language was a world apart from Grant's spare eloquence. Grant had admired Sumner's statesmanship and ardent abolitionism. Sumner, for his part, had high praise for Grant as a soldier, but reluctantly endorsed him for president and only belatedly threw his weight behind him during the 1868 race. Dismissing Grant as an intellectual lightweight, he fancied he would function as Grant's tutor on foreign policy and expected to be named Secretary of State as a reward for his support. His hopes were dashed when his friend Fish beat him out for the post, and he bristled further as Grant towed an independent line in foreign policy. With a sense of senatorial privilege, Sumner expected to dominate American foreign policy and suggested appointments. Mr. Sumner, who is the idol of the reformers, was among the first senators to ask offices for his friends, Grant noted. He expected offices as a right. Chairing the Foreign Relations Committee, he also expected his views to prevail. Sumner typified a Senate that had grown arrogant and imperious, demanding patronage as the price of its cooperation with the president. The press and reformers expected Grant to tame the headstrong Senate, a clash that would come to a head in his conflict with Sumner. Although Sumner failed to become Secretary of State, he scored a major victory in April 1869 when Grant named, at his recommendation, the historian John Lothrop Motley as Minister to England. A graduate of Harvard, Motley had studied in Germany, served in the diplomatic corps in St. Petersburg, and written a magisterial history of the Dutch Republic. Learned but irascible, a habitué of aristocratic drawing rooms, he had acted as American minister to the Austrian Empire until he started to find fault with Johnson administration policy and surrendered his post. When Motley returned to the United States, he delivered stirring campaign speeches for Grant, whom he had idolized during the war. Before the inauguration, he cultivated Grant's company, even reading manuscript chapters of Badeau's military history of Grant's wartime service. He impressed Grant as a gentleman, a scholar, and a man of ability, fully capable of representing his government in any capacity. Still, Grant had private reservations, complaining that Motley parts his hair in the middle and carries a single eyeglass. In truth, wrote Henry Adams, Grant disliked Motley at sight because they had nothing in common. Although he chafed at Sumner's pressure, Grant succumbed to his lobbying and appointed Motley, making Adam Badeau his assistant secretary of legation in London. Sumner prided himself on Motley's appointment, but it was to embroil Grant in protracted controversy with the self-aggrandizing senator. The flashpoint in their fractured relationship revolved around the CSS Alabama claims, which dated from the war. This incendiary issue dredged up potent emotions. Constructed in a British shipyard, the Alabama had been the most lethal Confederate blockade runner preying on Union ships, seizing or demolishing dozens before being destroyed by the USS Kearsarge off Cherbourg in June 1864. As Grant reminded people, the depredations of the Alabama and other Confederate raiders outfitted in England had wreaked havoc with Union shipping, driven up insurance costs, prolonged the war, and forced desperate American exporters to resort to foreign ships. In these ways, the indirect costs of the Alabama raids added up to stupendous sums, dealing a blow to America's merchant marine and forcing it to cede shipping supremacy to Great Britain. British dependence upon Southern cotton for its textile mills had engendered a pro-Southern bias in certain circles, and the Alabama's activities seemed to belie British claims to wartime neutrality. Grant had been incensed by this betrayal, complaining that the British government had supplied torpedoes, fuses, and guns to the Confederacy, all crafted in its arsenals. In the waning days of the Johnson administration, William Seward had pursued an indemnity from England, asking for all of Canada as recompense for crippled Union shipping. In the end, he settled for much less compensation incorporated into the Johnson-Clarendon Convention, which he submitted to the Senate as Grant was about to assume power. The agreement outraged the American electorate, which found it too timid in its demands upon the British. Grant believed that Seward had usurped his prerogatives as an incoming president by trying to arbitrate the Alabama claims at the close of the Johnson regime. The Johnson-Clarendon Convention still lay before the Senate when Grant became president, and Sumner delivered its coup de grace. On the Senate floor, he issued a flaming denunciation of the treaty, contending the Civil War had been doubled in duration by Britain's treacherous support for the Confederacy. Not simply wanting compensation for destroyed American vessels, he added a still more explosive demand: that Britain pay a staggering $2 billion in indirect damages for extending the war and undermining America's merchant marine. He wanted Canada thrown in as a lagniappe, and inflamed the situation further by calling for a British admission of guilt and an apology. Grant and Fish would have settled for an expression of regret. Sumner's words stirred up fellow senators, arousing such bellicose passions that the Senate defeated the Johnson-Clarendon Convention by a huge margin. With his speech, Sumner staked his claim to leadership in foreign policy under Grant. The British were shocked by Sumner's intemperate language. Lord Clarendon, Britain's foreign secretary, denounced him for the most extravagant hostility to England, while the Times of London called him a demagogue. The Grant administration was taken unawares by Sumner's screed. While sharing his indignation and seeking substantial reparations, Grant and Fish saw a chance for a negotiated solution with William Gladstone's new Liberal government and a rapprochement with England. Should this not occur, they feared war with England and an erosion in credit extended by British banks to American industry. Fish also hoped to push for Canadian independence, expecting the United States then to annex the country peacefully. Grant, although bitter over England's wartime duplicity, was a true blue Anglophile at heart. "England and the United States are natural allies and should be the best of friends," he declared in his memoirs. "They speak one language and are related by blood and other ties. We together are better qualified than any other people to establish commerce between all the nationalities of the world." That Sumner intended to oversee Alabama negotiations was underscored when Motley, before sailing to England, drew up a 15,000-word memorandum that would govern his diplomacy on the issue. It exuded the same venom as Sumner's speech, decrying British policy as a sin against humanity, a disgrace to civilization. It was undoubtedly influenced, if not partly drafted, by the senator himself. Fish found the document belligerent, suppressed it, and drew up more circumspect instructions. Sumner then confronted Fish and tried to induce him to accept the paper. Fish could be tough in a low-key way and refused to submit to Sumner's bullying. When Sumner threatened that he would urge Motley to resign, Fish refused to be blackmailed. For Grant, it came as a harsh initiation into the trouble an insolent senator could cause. By early June, the London Times reported that a social breach had opened between Grant and Sumner. Grant placed a high priority on something that should have pleased Sumner: the welfare of black citizens, to whom he offered unprecedented White House access. On December 11, 1869, he received a delegation from the mostly black National Labor Convention. While he couldn't gratify all their wishes, especially their desire to redistribute land to black laborers in the South, he left no doubt of his extreme solicitude for their concerns. "I have done all I could to advance the best interests of the citizens of our country without regard to color," he told them, "and I shall endeavor to do in the future what I have done in the past." Grant designated November 30th as the date for Mississippi and Texas to vote on new state constitutions that would guarantee black rights and readmit them to the Union. When Mississippi's new, heavily Republican legislature gathered in January, it signaled a radical shift in Southern politics in its selection of two new senators. One was Adelbert Ames, and the other, Hiram Revels, a minister who became the first black person to serve in the U.S. Senate. In a powerful piece of symbolism, Revels occupied the Senate seat once held by Jefferson Davis. Former slaves looked on with wonder as they gained a new place in state legislatures and in Washington. For many Southern whites, however, the idea that their erstwhile slaves could now hold office and even gain the upper hand in their political lives was intolerable. It reinforced their growing conviction that secession had been, as the nation phrased it, not wicked, but holy and glorious. Each step in black emancipation had led ineluctably to the next, and the controversial next goal was granting black males the right to vote. After the 13th Amendment abolished slavery and the 14th conferred citizenship rights upon blacks, the 15th prevented states from denying voting rights based on race, color, or earlier condition of servitude. For Grant, this last amendment embodied the logical culmination of everything he had fought for during the war. In Badeau's words, he thought that, in order to secure the Union which he desired and which the Northern people had fought for, a voting population at the South friendly to the Union was indispensable. He watched ratification of the 15th Amendment with the keenest sympathy. "You will see by the papers that the ratification of the 15th Amendment is assured," he exulted to Elihu Washburne in late January 1870. "With this question out of politics and Reconstruction completed, I hope to see such good feeling in Congress as to secure rapid legislation and an early adjournment." On February 3rd, the 15th Amendment was ratified, and its acceptance required for every Southern state readmitted to the Union. On March 30th, as 100 guns boomed in the Capitol in celebration, Grant composed an unusual message to Congress, celebrating that the amendment had become part of the Constitution that day, and his words fervently embraced black suffrage. "A measure which makes at once 4 millions of people heretofore declared by the highest tribunal in the land not citizens of the United States, nor eligible to become so, voters in every part of the land, the right not to be abridged by any state, is indeed a measure of grander importance than any other one act of the kind from the foundation of our free government to the present day. The adoption of the 15th Amendment constitutes the most important event that has occurred since the nation came into life." It was a stunning statement of Grant's faith in the new black electorate. He further urged Congress to promote popular education so that all who possess and exercise political rights shall have the opportunity to acquire the knowledge which will make their share in the government a blessing. That evening, to commemorate the landmark amendment, thousands marched down Pennsylvania Avenue in a torchlight procession. When they gathered outside the White House, Grant came out to address them and stressed the extraordinary importance he attached to the amendment, lauding it as a seminal act and saying, "There had been no event since the close of the war in which I have felt so deep an interest. It looked to me as the realization of the Declaration of Independence." Grant's brother-in-law, Michael John Kramer, later explained that Grant had initially worried about bestowing voting rights upon black citizens, some of them still illiterate. Ku Klux Klan terror wiped away that hesitation. For as the Klan endeavored to suppress the political rights of the freedmen of the South by the use of unscrupulous means, etc., he, the head of the army, became convinced that the ballot was the only real means the freedmen had for defending their lives, property, and rights. This fateful moment presented Grant with a domestic challenge as daunting as that faced by any American president, for it inspired hope among blacks and smoldering resentment among many whites. Before long, Southern blacks held office as lieutenant governors, militia officers, state legislators, and secretaries of state, not to mention coroners, constables, judges, and county magistrates. 600 served as Southern legislators during Reconstruction. Black gains can be overstated, and certainly were by an alarmed white community. Fewer than 20% of state political offices in the South were held by blacks at the height of Reconstruction. Still, these represented spectacular gains for people so recently chained in bondage. The dread of black suffrage drove many former secessionists to new heights of indignation. Although blacks made up 13% of the total U.S. population, they constituted 36% of the South, with outright majorities in Mississippi and South Carolina. The 15th Amendment meant that blacks, armed with the vote, could exercise real power and invert, in an astonishingly short period the power structure that had long suppressed them. Many Southern whites found this insupportable and argued that hapless, newly enfranchised blacks were being manipulated by scheming Northern Republicans. Woodrow Wilson would express this stereotypical view. Unscrupulous adventurers appeared to act as the leaders of the inexperienced blacks in taking possession, first of the conventions and afterwards of the state governments. Negroes submitted to the unrestrained authority of small and masterful groups of white men whom the instincts of plunder had drawn from the North. Not surprisingly, the 15th Amendment incited a violent backlash among whites whose nerves were already frayed by having lost the war and their valuable holdings of human property. Hardly had the ink dried on the new amendment than Southern demagogues began to pander to the anxieties it aroused. In West Virginia, an overwhelmingly white state, Democratic politicians sounded the battle cry of electing a white man's government to gain control of the governorship and state legislature. "The spirit of the late rebellion is in the ascendant," one Republican politician admitted. "Hostility to Negro suffrage was the prime element of our defeat." To circumvent the 15th Amendment, white politicians in Georgia devised new methods of stripping blacks of voting rights, including poll taxes, onerous registration requirements, and similar restrictions copied in other states. With a violent backlash well underway, the party of Lincoln began to pay a price for being the vocal paladin of African Americans. As Senator Henry Wilson observed in 1869, there was not a square mile of the United States where Republican advocacy of black rights hadn't resulted in the loss of white votes. Behind the 15th Amendment's idealism lay the stark reality that a solid South of white voters would vote en masse for the Democratic Party, forcing the Republicans to create a countervailing political force. Under Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution, slaveholding states had been entitled to count 3 of every 5 slaves as part of their electorate in computing their share of congressional delegates. Now former slaves would count as full citizens, swelling the electoral tally for Southern states. This was fine as long as freed people exercised their full voting rights. Instead, over time, the white South would receive extra delegates in Congress and electoral votes in presidential races while stifling black voting power. "It was unjust to the North," Grant subsequently lamented. "In giving the South Negro suffrage, we have given the old slaveholders 40 votes in the Electoral College. They keep those votes, but disenfranchise the Negroes. That is one of the gravest mistakes in the policy of Reconstruction." Just as the 15th Amendment was enacted, Grant was given an unusual opportunity to reshape the Supreme Court. Shortly after taking office, he had signed a bill expanding the current roster of justices from 8 to 9, effective December 1869. To fill the new vacancy, on December 14th, he nominated his Attorney General, Ebenezer Hoar. Uneasy with 2 Massachusetts men, Hoar and Boutwell, in his cabinet, Grant imagined a court appointment for Hoar offered an elegant solution to the problem. An estimable jurist with extensive experience on the Massachusetts High Court, Hoar seemed an unexceptionable choice. But a week later, the Senate tabled his nomination. Senators were irked by Hoar's stiff opposition to the spoils system and his sparring with radical Republicans over Reconstruction. Instead of withdrawing the nomination, the stubborn Grant dug in his heels and became combative as he took on entrenched senators. In his diary, Hamilton Fish noted that Grant had decided to withhold political patronage from senators opposed to the policy or attitude of the administration. Nevertheless, Hoar was voted down decisively. The episode perpetuated the tension between the president and the Senate that had flared up so unforgettably under Andrew Johnson. Meanwhile, an elderly associate justice, 75-year-old Robert C. Greer, who was elevated to the court by President Polk in 1846, notified Grant that he was resigning for medical reasons opening a second vacancy. At this point, Grant turned to a well-known aspirant for the court, Edwin Stanton, who had enjoyed a prosperous pre-war legal career arguing cases before the High Court. His wish to join the court was fiercely held, dating back to Lincoln's cabinet, and he now hungered for the honor, aided by his congressional admirers. Stanton was still weak from his wartime labors and had recently suffered from poor health. When he made a courtesy call at the White House soon after Grant became president, Julia was shocked that he looked pale and feeble. Because of his shaky medical condition, she claimed, her husband was eager to give Stanton his last shot at the court. Never slow in self-assertion, Stanton boasted to a friend in October 1869, "There is a vacancy on the Supreme Bench for which I have adequate physical power, and so far as I can judge of my intellect, its powers are as acute and vigorous as at any period of my life, and perhaps more so." Some in the press wondered whether the cantankerous Stanton possessed an even judicial temperament. Nonetheless, he enlisted enthusiastic supporters on Capitol Hill, including Vice President Colfax and House Speaker James G. Blaine, who bombarded Grant with lists of legislators clamoring for his appointment. On December 20th, bowing to pressure, Grant nominated Stanton to replace Greer. Thanking Grant, Stanton reflected that a Supreme Court seat was the only public office I ever desired, and I accept it with great pleasure. Stanton's name flew through the Senate confirmation process, winning approval by a 46-11 vote. Then he died of heart failure days later, at age 55. Whatever his reservations about Stanton's abrasive personality, Grant eulogized him as one of America's most distinguished citizens and faithful public servants, and ordered the White House draped in mourning and government offices shut for the funeral. Stanton's death gave the country a chance to pay tribute to one of the gigantic figures generated by the war. It also left Grant in a forgiving mood, and he attempted to advance the fortunes of Stanton's son, making him his personal attorney. "If I were asked to name the greatest men of the Republic," Grant later opined, "I certainly should include Stanton among them." Although Stanton never served a day on the High Court, Grant sent his widow Ellen as a keepsake, his lapsed commission as a Supreme Court justice. In the end, Grant named two new members to the Supreme Court, Joseph P. Bradley and William Strong. Strong was a proficient attorney from Philadelphia, a product of Yale College and law school. Because he was a solid unionist and a Republican Party member since the late 1850s, Lincoln had contemplated appointing him Chief Justice after Roger B. Taney died in 1864. Never a judicial statesman, he was nonetheless widely respected for legal competence, and Justice Greer commended him as an accomplished and sound lawyer. He also had the right political credentials, one newspaper praising him for being sufficiently radical for even the most radical senators. The other new justice, Joseph P. Bradley, son of a farmer from upstate New York, had worked as a lawyer in Newark, New Jersey, representing railroads and insurance companies. Like Strong, he had been an ardent unionist, having written that secession has always been treason. With a court composed solely of justices from north of the Mason-Dixon line, Grant came under pressure to add a Southerner, completing the re-entry of the former Confederate states, but he was deterred by skeptics. "If you yield to the clamor to nominate a Southern man," Elihu Washburn warned, 10-1 you will be sold out in the end. See how Lincoln came out in his appointments of Supreme Judges." Grant appears to have heeded the advice.